Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We're in chapter 12 of the book of Genesis. We've made it all the way to chapter 12 at long last. We hit the first couple of verses of it last week, and I told you that for the next several weeks, we're going to be talking a lot about Abraham, because the next big chunk of the book of Genesis is about Abraham. And it's going to introduce us to the second covenant, called a covenant, that you find in the Old Testament. The first was the covenant that God made with Noah, which was basically a promise to all mankind that he was never going to flood the earth again and kill everything by a flood. And he said he was going to put his rainbow in the sky as a constant reminder to both God and man that God was never going to flood the world again. But now we come across the second covenant in the Old Testament. Now we have to talk for a moment about the difference between covenants. There are some covenants in the Bible that are conditional. There are some covenants in the Bible that are unconditional. And it really matters that you identify which is which, because the Abrahamic covenant is completely and utterly unconditional. And what I mean by that is God does not require anything of Abraham in order for God to keep his promise to Abraham. Instead, once God actually ratifies it as a covenant, God is going to put Abraham to sleep so that Abraham can't physically participate in the formation of the covenant. And then while Abraham's asleep, God is going to, in two symbols, move through the split, divided animals forming the covenant. So it is a promise that God makes with himself. And Abraham is simply the recipient of it. It is an unconditional covenant. You get that? Whereas the Mosaic covenant, the Sinai covenant, very conditional covenant. God puts all sorts of conditions on it. He says, do all this stuff. If you do, I'll bless you. If you do, I'll protect you from your enemies. If you do, I'll give you plenty in your harvest. If you do, I'll protect you. And if you don't, I will curse you and I will smite you and I will drive you out of your land. I'll even bring on death if you don't keep the covenant. That's really conditional. So in the Old Testament, you have examples of conditional and unconditional covenants. Then the New Testament, which is just another way of saying the New Covenant. The New Testament books introduce us to the New Covenant, and that becomes the theme of the New Testament books, the fact that God has made a brand new covenant. And it really matters, when you talk about New Covenant, it really matters how you define New Covenant. Is it conditional or is it unconditional? I contend that the New Covenant is unconditional where we humans are concerned. Every condition necessary was met in Christ. Christ himself satisfied every condition God would have put forward, so that when it comes to you and I and our salvation, there are no conditions. The reason that is so important is because of how much Christianity will tell you what you got to do to get saved, what you got to do to be in the new covenant, and they'll start listing the conditions. And we all grew up in that kind of religion, right? Where they say, you know, if you want to please God and if you want to get into heaven, you gotta X, Y, and Z. You gotta do this stuff. As soon as they do that, they're saying salvation, the new covenant, Christianity, God's forgiveness, heaven forever is conditional. It is based on conditions. You gotta do stuff. But the biblical paradigm of the new covenant is that it is completely unconditional where you and I are concerned. And all of that is demonstrated in the way that God deals with Abraham early on here. When we find Abraham, he's in Ur of the Chaldees, and according to the extra-biblical records, his father was an idol maker. So it's not like he was looking for God, searching out God, seeking God, wanting God, didn't know much about God. While he's in Ur of the Chaldees, God comes to him and tells him, leave your family and leave your people and go to a country I'm going to show you. And once he gets there, says, from you, I'm going to make a great nation. and through you, all the nations, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. And nowhere does he say, if you will just do this or that. Instead, he simply says, we're going to do these things. Later on, in a couple of chapters, Abraham is going to get into a little bit of a debate with God, which he does a couple of times, and I find it really interesting when he decides to discuss and argue with God, and God takes it exceptionally well, I think, considering how many people in the Bible argue with God, and God does not take it well. When it comes to Abraham, God takes it exceptionally well, which means there's hope for people like me. And so Abraham actually says to God, you keep promising me that I'm going to have all this seed, that I'm going to have all these descendants, I'm going to have all these people. Have you noticed that I have no children and that my only descendant is this servant, this Eliezer, my servant? And so I'm guessing he's going to be the heir of all this stuff. And then God says, basically, yeah, it's all true. Your wife is way past childbearing and you're old, and I'm going to give you an heir through Sarah, your wife, though that seems impossible. And Abraham believes God. And the next verse says, and God counted it to him for righteousness. In other words, he believed what God said, and God imputed righteousness to him in exchange for his faithful belief that what God said God would do. So now start putting these elements together, and you have the formation of a very genuine theology of how you become righteous. And the New Testament writers, particularly Paul, and certainly in the Galatian letter, and you're going to read it in the Hebrew letter, they go back to that event. They go back to that central moment that Moses writes about so early in the history of the formation of Israel, that the first man called a Hebrew had righteousness imputed to him before there ever was a law, before there was ever a priesthood, before there was ever Israel as a people group. Nevertheless, God imputed righteousness to him. So you have an unconditional covenant. Through you, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. I have chosen you, and I have given you righteousness, imputed it to you, because you believe me. And of course, then you get into the book of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 12 starts right off with, we look unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith. So if Abraham did believe God, where did he get that? God gave him that. God gave him whatever ability, strength, power he needed to believe God. So God gives him the faith and then imputes righteousness to him in exchange for his faith and does all of this unconditionally. If any of that sounds familiar, it's because that is the basis of the new covenant. Is that God says things to us, he gives us the faith to believe what he has said to us, and then he imputes righteousness to us for believing it, with no conditions. And so the Abrahamic covenant is absolutely essential to a right understanding of the whole New Testament, the New Covenant. And again, this is where so many people get their theology confused, because they don't understand the stipulations and the details of each successive covenant. And Paul in the book of Galatians is going to say that the Sinai covenant, the law, came and left, but it did not do away with the covenant that came 400 years before through Abraham. So he argues that the Abrahamic covenant has an ongoing, lasting influence because it is, in fact, an unconditional covenant that God made with himself. And the writer of Hebrews goes on to say, because it's a covenant that God made with himself by two witnesses, the smoke and the fire, and then he says, so it is impossible for God to lie, because he has given himself two witnesses, both of which are eternal witnesses. So it is impossible for God to lie where the Abrahamic covenant is concerned. So everything you read in the Abrahamic covenant, every element, every detail of the Abrahamic covenant must come true, or God lied, and the writer of Hebrews also lied, because he said it's impossible for God to lie where this is concerned, because he himself is the foundation and the surety of this unconditional covenant. You get all that? Okay, you had your hand up.
Why didn't Moses say, I don't get this. What is this covenant you're doing through me? This seems to contradict what we have gotten with Abraham, our father. We can't do this.
There are a couple things. Part of the reason I think Moses learned not to argue is that the first time he argued was about circumcising his child, and God met him in an inn with the intention of killing him. Later he argued and killed an Egyptian slave master, And so God put him 40 years on the backside of nowhere while he learned to grow up. And then later, he struck the stone a second time when God said, speak to the stone. And God said, for that, you don't get to see the promised land. You know, Moses has a long history of these sort of temper outbursts. God every time has to correct his attitude. So first off, I don't think that Moses argued because God eventually just taught him to be what was eventually called a meek man. Gee, where did he learn that kind of meekness through God's constant attitude readjustment? Secondly, Moses, I think, is an obedient servant. Jesus says Moses was faithful in all his house. And so when God comes to you on a mountaintop like that and says, here's the deal now, I don't think you argue about that. When you've got that much power behind it and the finger of God writing down, here are my rules, I don't think you argue about that. Thirdly, that was the founding document that codified Israel as a nation, as a national people separate from all other nations. And so it really did have its place historically in the development of the offspring of Abraham. It actually gave them a national identity and gave them a sign, an insignia, we are God's people, both because they were circumcised because of Abraham, but now they were keeping the Sabbath. They were the people under God's law. They were the people of Yahweh. And so they had plenty of reason not to argue about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So chapter 12, verse 1. Chapter 12, verse 2 is going to be the first place where we see promises God is making to Abraham that begin to develop the Abrahamic covenant. If you've got a pencil and paper, start writing down these promises because they're going to grow from this point forward. I was tempted to start writing them on the board. Well, let's do that. Let's just start writing them on the board. Everybody knows there's a baptism service a week from Sunday, right? 6 o'clock. Abrahamic covenant. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from your kindred and from your father's house or your father's family, all of your relatives, and go to a land that I will show you. A remarkable amount of faith was required for Abram to say, yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm going to leave everything I know. I'm going to leave my family, my kindred, my father's household. I'm going to take my wife and Lot and his wife and whatever my belongings are, which originally were not that great, and I'm going to just go to a place. I'm just going to start walking. And God eventually is going to say, okay, this is it. Do you realize how much faith it took to just get up and start walking? In Hebrews 11, classically called the Heroes of Faith passage, that's one of the moments that the writer of Hebrews points to and says, Abraham, by faith, sojourned in a land that he didn't know. It took faith for him to say, yeah, okay, God, let's do that. Let's just start walking. And he says, unto a land I will show you, I will make of you a great nation. So number one, I will make of you a great nation. Nobody erase this board. Because over the next couple chapters, and then into Isaac, really, and into Jacob from there, the promises keep building, keep growing. So don't erase this. I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. So you're going to have a great name. Big reputation. By the way, it's roughly 4,000 years later. We're still talking about him. Great name. I would say that worked out okay. I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. You shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you. I will curse them that curse you. Oh, well, that's divine protection. So let's just say blessing and cursing. I will bless them that bless thee. I will curse them that curses thee. And in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Do you realize what a mammoth promise that is? And so far God didn't say, if you will just, nothing. All families blessed. So, first time God encounters Abraham, Abraham encounters God, Abraham gets all this. This is the beginning of the promise. Of all the people on planet Earth, God spoke to one guy and said, I'll make of you a great nation, I'm going to give you a great name. You're going to be a blessing. Those that bless you, I will bless. Those that curse you, I will curse. And all the families of the earth are going to be blessed through you. Based on what? Based on a promise. Just based on a promise. Not based on anything in Abraham. And I want you to get this because these are huge, magnificent promises that God makes because he's huge and magnificent. And he can make huge, magnificent promises if he wants. And he can give those promises to anybody he wants because the promise isn't based in the quality of the person. It's based in the quality of the God who's making the promise. And so he can promise you anything he wants to promise you and make it good because he's God. And so if he says something to you that is equally unbelievable, like, I'll take you to heaven and you'll stand before me eternally, spotless, unblemished, perfected forever. I still can't wrap my brain around that. I know it says it, but I still can't wrap my brain around what it would be like to stand in front of the holy magnificence of God and have him actually look at me in an approving way. To have a being, to have a life that is free of my mortal sinfulness. There was a quote that I've quoted enough times, Marvin Stoniker said many years ago that I never forgot. He said, the best prayer I ever prayed has enough sin in it to put me in hell forever. And that's right. Can you imagine what it would be like to get to worship God without the sinfulness of who and what you are and what you're like? Wouldn't it be grand to have all that sin part of you completely removed and to stand before God washed, purified, perfected, and then worship? Oh my goodness. I can't even imagine what that's going to be like. To sit down at a table with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the great people of faith, the people we can look at and go, well, yes, them, but why me? To think that we're all going to sit together in the kingdom, just unbelievable promises. Why can we believe these quote-unquote unbelievable promises? Because God said so. And he's big enough and grand enough to say anything he wants to say to anybody he wants to say it to. And if he can say all that to Abraham, and by the way, that's just the setup. He's just starting. He's going to go on and say things like, yeah, you want to know how many kids you're going to have? If you can count the grains of sand on the seashore, that's how many kids you're going to have. These are gigantic promises God starts doling out. And it's not based in anything in Abraham because there's no human being who could live up to, who could earn, who could deserve this kind of wonderful promise. But God goes way beyond just the physical and the blessing and the land promises when he gets into the new covenant and starts making even more grandiose promises to people who can't possibly deserve it. Where do we get the confidence that he's going to do all those things? Because he is this great, big, grand, magnificent God who can make promises based on his character, based on his attributes and nature, and not based on anything in us. That's what I mean by unconditional. You got all that? Because how you view the Abrahamic covenant has to color how you view the new covenant. And I get very, very weary of listening to people talk about Christianity and the new covenant as a conditional thing. But if you're going to add conditions to the new covenant, then you have to equally, to keep the balance, you have to equally add conditions to the Abrahamic covenant, which God simply never does. And that's really, really obvious in the Abrahamic covenant. It should be equally obvious in the new covenant. Verse 4. So, Abraham departed. Isn't that incredible? God shows up and says, leave your people, leave your family, I'm going to show you a land, and I'm going to do all this absolutely astounding stuff to you. And so Abraham goes, yeah, okay, good, and goes, as the Lord had spoken unto him. And Lot went with him, and Abraham was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. 75 years old, no kids. Now, if you followed in the previous chapters, especially in chapter 11, as we looked at all the family record of Shem, one of the things that we saw and that I tried to emphasize after the flood was that the lifespan of human beings was becoming progressively shorter and shorter. As a result, people were having children younger and younger. And you start seeing that men live 30 years and then started producing heirs. I think that's significant because Abram here is said to be 75. Still no kids. Lifespan now is getting shorter. It's into the 120s, 150s. He's halfway or more through his life. No kids. And God is saying things like, through you, through your seed, through your descendants, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. No kids. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him. Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarah, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. I've been pointing out for a couple of weeks, Canaan is the line that's been cursed now. Abram is a descendant of Shem, the blessed line. So God is taking Abram of the blessed line of Shem and giving him the land that belongs to Canaan, the cursed line. So you can see in this that God is serving several functions. Not only is he blessing the lineage of Shem through Abram, but he's also making good on his curse against Canaan as he brings in the Israelites, the Shemites, to occupy their land. So God is actually making good on several promises here. Verse 6, and Abram passed through the land unto the place of Sichem, unto the plain of Morah, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abraham and said, unto thy seed I will give this land. So now, number 6, he's promised him the land of Canaan. So the promise grows. Now, as we look at these first few, a great nation, it's pretty easy to say, well, if he's going to make him a great nation, if we're talking about physical descendants here, that's a very physical-sounding promise. That's one you can actually check. That's when you can say, okay, what about the descendants of Abraham? Did they become a lot of people or didn't they? Turns out they did. They became a lot of people, physical people. They became a lot of people. And we, as we progress through this, we'll get into the debate about whether those who have the same faith as Abraham that Paul talks about in the book of Galatians, we'll talk about whether they help fulfill this promise. I say no, that the promise is a physical promise and it's fulfilled in a physical way. The writer of Hebrews says so. Certainly David talks about it in the Psalms, that God kept his promise in making them a great nation of people in a very physical way. So I say that's a pretty physical promise. I'm going to make you a great name, a great reputation. You're going to be a blessing. Those that bless you, I'll bless. Those that curse you, I'll curse. Through you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. I have no problem saying those are all very spiritual things. Those are very spiritual promises. God is saying blessing and cursing. And so I have no argument that those are spiritual promises. But when God says, see this land, this dirt, this piece of the planet, see this geographic area, am I getting physical enough yet? See this rock, see this chunk of ground. I'm going to give this to you and your descendants forever. Do you think God knows what forever means? Think he has any concept of the whole forever thing? And it's a very physical promise. I'm going to give you this physical land. Now that's something you can actually check. That's something you can go into history and say, okay, did they ever occupy that land? The answer is yes. They occupied that land for a while. Did they keep the land? No. Why didn't they keep the land? God says that he took them out of the land of promise because they didn't keep his law, conditions. So does that negate the promise? No, the Old Testament is full of promises saying, even though you haven't kept my law, even though you've been rebellious, even though you've been like an adulterous wife, even though you haven't been true to me, even though you haven't dealt honestly and forthrightly with me, I nevertheless am going to come, I'm going to get you, I'm going to woo you, I'm going to bring you back to myself, I'm going to bring you back to your land, I'm going to plant you and you're never going to be moved, and you're going to possess the gates of your enemies. And all these promises are given to the self-same physical group of people. And so I insist, that's the verb I went with, I do not imply, I do not suggest, I insist I'm busy insisting up here. Does anybody care? Okay. I insist that the land of Canaan promise, the land promise, is a physical promise and cannot be successfully spiritualized away. And a lot of people try to. They'll say the land of Canaan is actually a type of heaven. And when the Israelites did their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness and they came across the Jordan River, that's emblematic of dying. And you go across the River Jordan as you die, and then you enter the promised land, which is heaven. Of course, the Israelites got there, found out there were giants in the land, and then had to fight and conquer Jericho, and then engage in a series of wars for the next several hundred years. So apparently, if that's a type of heaven, heaven's going to be a real drag for a lot of us, because we get there and we got to fight right away, and there's giants and there's enemies and there's no way to make that parallel work. The reality is God has made a physical promise to a physical seed, physical descendants, a great nation. Those physical descendants, a great nation, get the land of Canaan, physical promise for physical people. And that promise is not fulfilled until those people have that land. And just because, I said it last week, I'll probably say it every week that we're talking about the Abrahamic covenant, just because you can find spiritual fulfillments of the Abrahamic covenant, that doesn't negate the physical promises. Because all the families of the earth are going to be blessed in his seed. If you want to point to Christ on that one and say Christ is the seed, which certainly the book of Galatians says, that Christ is the seed, and all the families of the earth, that means all the people groups on earth, will be blessed through Christ, and then the book of Revelation, it's every kindred and tribe and tongue and nation that make up the redeemed in heaven, then yes, all the families of the earth are being blessed in Christ. I have no problem with that. That is the perfect spiritual fulfillment of a perfectly spiritual promise. No problem with that. But that does not negate the physical promise. Because as I said last week and showed you and will continue to talk about, eventually the Abrahamic covenant is divided between its physical promise and its spiritual promise. And the spiritual promise of the seed leading to Christ goes through Judah, and the physical inheritance, called the birthright inheritance, is passed on to the northern tribes, to Ephraim. Until Ephraim, the northern tribes, inherit Canaan and are planted there never to be moved again, these promises are not fulfilled. I'm the type to say, well, God did keep the promise that all the families of the earth were going to be blessed in Christ. Isn't that evidence that he's keeping the Abrahamic covenant? Well, then that should give us all the more confidence that he's going to keep the physical promises. The physical ones are easy compared to these gigantic spiritual promises. And instead, the church world all too often is prone to say, no, now that Christ has come, and the fact that Israel has not yet inherited their land is proof that God didn't mean that. He didn't mean physical promise of physical land for physical people. He meant all of that to be allegorized, spiritualized, to be understood in some much more spiritual way. But if you look at the promise, this land, your people, there's nothing spiritual in that outside of I chose you and I chose this land and your people get this land. So I do not like the allegorical approach to those passages. And I am insistent. Good, that time I got a mild chuckle. That's good. It's all in the delivery. Abraham passed through the land of Shechem under the plain of Moreh, and the Canaanite was in the land, and the Lord appeared unto Abraham and said, unto your seed I will give this land. I got to ask one more question. Is anything in that phrase vague? Difficult to understand? Requiring interpretation?
From a time standpoint, it's a bit open-ended, but not the fact of...
Yeah, he doesn't say when.
Right.
Oh, and that's really important you say that, because the writer of Hebrews, and we're going to get into all of this, we have to. The writer of Hebrews in chapter 11 starts with, Abraham lived as a pilgrim, as a sojourner, in the land of promise, with Isaac and Jacob, who were also heirs of that same promise. And these all died not having obtained the promise. What promise hadn't they obtained?
The land.
The land. Did they obtain the spiritual end of it? Yes, Christ has come. That's the whole point of the book of Hebrews. It's all about, yes, the new covenant is here, and it's far better than the old covenant. Let's not go back to the way of the old covenant. We are perfected forever in Christ. That end of the promise completely fulfilled, but there's still, according to chapter 11, some promise not fulfilled. And then it goes on to talk about all the great heroes of faith through the Old Testament, and then says, these all died not having obtained the promise. And then after having said, these all died not having obtained the promise, his conclusion is that the reason is that God did not perfect them without us, Hebrew writing to Hebrews, after the cross, having some better thing in mind for all of us collectively. So when you think about the fact that the chapter begins with the land promise and then goes through all the Hebrews in history who didn't get the promise and then concludes with, it's because God didn't want them without us to be complete. He wanted us all as a group to gain this promise. What's he talking about? Future fulfillment of an unfulfilled promise of the land. And there's no other way to, well, I can't say there is no other way to read chapter 11 because, as Alex was about to point out, the amillennialists and covenantalists work very hard to understand it some other way. Is that what you were about to?
Well, yeah, and I can understand because the track they're on is there's no millennium, and so they keep thinking he must be referring to the unveiling of this mystery of Jesus, you know.
Look, since I've brought it up, everybody turn to Hebrews 11. I don't want any confusion here. I don't want to just hit it and go. This is probably a good place to read anyway because it is going to talk about Abraham and his faith as I referenced a moment ago. So let's take a moment and read a little bit of Hebrews 11. We're going to spend a fair amount of time in Hebrews as we work through the next couple chapters of Genesis because it is a commentary on so much of what we're reading in Genesis. And so to get a really biblical understanding of Genesis, we have to read the Hebrew commentary on it. I'm waiting. People are flipping. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. The best definition of faith anywhere in the Bible. Faith is the substance, hypostasis, I believe is the word, of the things that we hope for, the things that we are confidently anticipating. The way that we know that things like heaven exists is the fact that we have faith, that faith as a gift from God is the proof positive that everything else we're told and everything else we believe exists because the faith exists, that the faith is a gift from God that is the down payment that proves the rest of it. And in fact, the evidence of things not seen has to do with like the title deed, that when you put down earnest money, when you're going to buy a house, you put down a down payment where you say, I'm definitely going to buy this house and here's the earnest of it. This is the same idea here. All that stuff that we believe, all the stuff that we hope for, all the things we've been promised, the down payment of all that stuff is faith. And that's the point the writer is making here. For by it, by faith, the elders, who are the elders? The ancients, the Hebrew ancients. For by it the elders obtained a good report. Through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. In other words, in early Genesis, when God spoke and things were, the writer of Hebrews is arguing here, it's not that he made it out of stuff that already existed. Where there was nothing, there was suddenly everything. He spoke the universe into existence. By faith, verse 4, by faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts. And by it, he being dead yet speaks. By faith Enoch was translated that he should not see death and was not found, because God had translated him. For before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. Now he's going to tell us in what way he pleased God, but without faith, it is impossible to please him. And so his argument is, since it says that Enoch pleased God, he must have had faith. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. For he that cometh to God must believe that God is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Verse 7, by faith Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. This is chronologically just going right through Genesis. This is everything we've read so far in the book of Genesis. He's chronologically walking through all those early people we've already met in the first 12 chapters and saying any goodness they had, any positive relationship that they had with God was the result of faith. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelt, look at the next phrase, in the
land of promise.
Very important phrase, because now we're talking about a promise. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. What's the same promise?
The land promise.
And as we work our way through Genesis, you're going to see God tell both of them, Isaac and Jacob, that the land is theirs. He's going to continue to expand on this land promise and tell Isaac and Jacob each, this land is yours. Verse 10, for he waited for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Now, this is the place where those who want to spiritualize jump on that verse and say, well, Abraham, when he was walking into Canaan and he heard the Canaan promise and the land promise, Abraham himself understood that it was a spiritual promise. And that's what it says right here, that even though he was walking in a physical land, he was looking for a city whose builder and maker was God, which means he was looking for heaven. He was looking for a heavenly city, and he understood that Canaan was a type of heaven where God was the builder and the maker. That's the way the argument goes. But what this actually says, if you just read what the Hebrews writer was writing, what he says is, he dwelt in the land of promise in tents. He dwelt as a pilgrim in a foreign country. Even though he was the heir of it, nevertheless, he didn't possess it. That's his point. And then says, for he waited for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. This is the writer of Hebrews writing after the fact, after the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, and saying, even Abraham is waiting for the fulfillment of the promise until the promise is fulfilled in a city whose builder and maker is God. What city is that?
Jerusalem.
The New Jerusalem, of course. So even early on, he's saying, yeah, Abraham was a sojourner, was a pilgrim in the land of promise, and he never received the promise. Why? Because God is going to fulfill it in all of collective Israel, not just in Abraham. So keep reading. By faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed. We're going to read about that. Therefore, from one man, verse 12, therefore from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. So the writer of Hebrews takes that promise physically. He did physically produce as many people as the stars in the sand. So he sees it as a very physical promise. These, verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promise. What promise?
Land promise.
It's the promise we're talking about. The context is all about the land. The context is the promise made to Abraham about the land. These all died not having received the promise. But having seen it afar off, they were assured of the promises, and they embraced them, and they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they do seek a homeland. So we're still talking about homeland, we're still talking about strangers and pilgrims, we're still talking about descendants of Abraham who did not receive the promise of the land. Right? Have I read anything into the text yet? Yet, like I'm going to later, but have I?
Not yet.
Okay. Verse 16, but now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country or a heavenly city, whichever your word country, city, whatever after that's added by the translator. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them.
Well, it's interesting the way he says that God would be ashamed if he didn't give them that city.
Absolutely.
Because he's a liar.
Right, exactly. And God will not be ashamed in all these things. He's going to. But look at the language. The language starts with Abraham was promised a country. He didn't get it. All of the early forefathers, they didn't get the promise, but they all saw it afar off and by faith embraced it and he puts it out into the future, God is still going to keep this promise. By faith, Abraham was tested. From there, he goes into, by faith, Isaac and Jacob and Esau, concerning all the things to come. Jacob, when he was dying, blessed the sons of Joseph. He gets into, by faith, Moses. He gets into, starting in like verse 30, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down, by faith the harlot Rahab did not perish. What more shall I say in verse 32? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samson and the prophets, all of them, he's arguing. I could talk about their faith. Who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of aliens, women received their dead raised to life again, others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection, still others had trials of mockings and scourgings, yes, of chains and imprisonment, they were stoned, they were sawn in half, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword, they wandered about in sheepskin and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy, they wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth, and all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. What promise? The land promise. Is that true? Yes, right up until the time the writer of Hebrews was writing, none of these great heroes of the history of Israel had obtained the land promise. So what does he say? He doesn't say, so now we need to spiritualize the promise. It's to be understood as a type of heaven. Instead, his conclusion is, and all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God, having something better for us, the Hebrews that were alive and remaining as he was writing, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. In other words, it was always God's plan to not give them the land until we Hebrews collectively all get the land together. And then you get into the book of Revelation, you see the New Jerusalem, you see the regathering of the 12 tribes, you see Paul in Romans 11 talking about all Israel will be saved. You see this consistent testimony of God's regathering of all Israel to take them to the New Jerusalem to give them the land that has always been promised to them. And it just couldn't be more consistent if you just let the text say what it says. And that is why I insist that the land of Canaan promise is a physical promise that God must keep physically. And by the way, so does the writer of Hebrews. Now, of course, then chapter 12 starts right in with, therefore, we also, writing to the Hebrews that were alive at the time he was writing, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, all these people by faith who went before us who didn't receive the promise, we have this great cloud of witnesses, so let us lay aside every weight and the sin that does so easily ensnare us, and let us run with endurance this race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith. In your translations, if it says our in there, that's added by the translators. It's in italics if you have one of those italicized versions. Scratch that out. What it says is, he is the author and finisher of faith. So wherever you see faith, all the way back to Abraham, Christ was the author and finisher of faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you should become weary and discouraged in your own souls. You have not yet resisted all the way to bloodshed, striving against sin. So the context there is about faith and about the heroes of faith in the Old Testament, and that faith is a gift from Christ, and they all by faith had a good report with God, and they all, despite their good report of faith, did not receive the promise of the land that we just read about. So it's no surprise then to us, at least it shouldn't be. And there certainly shouldn't be any confusion, and there shouldn't be any debate, and there shouldn't be any controversy. It's very clear that New Testament writers, after the cross, were still writing about the land promise and saying, it's true, none of our progenitors got it. But it's because God had something better in store for all of us collectively, so that they, without us, would not be made complete. That we'll all get it together. And then New Jerusalem. So again, very, very consistent. Okay, back to Genesis. To me, and maybe it's just because I'm hard-headed, or maybe it's because I'm so insistent on letting the text speak, but to me that is just so phenomenally plain and clear that it astounds me when I read the plethora of books that are out there arguing the amillennial or covenantal point of view that the land promise is done away with, and God's done with Israel, and he's scattered them once and for all, and all the promises that were made in the Old Testament now apply to the church. And I don't know how they get that when you have a Hebrew writing to Hebrews after the cross and saying, right, they didn't get that part of the promise, but they will. God still has a plan for them.
So Hebrews, and if you continue in, that's basically an exhortation that this, the struggling that they're going through was gone through by all the people before them.
Exactly.
And that we're not going to avoid it.
Right.
So that we all can go into the land.
And now writing to Christian Hebrews,
right,
converted Christian Hebrews,
right,
and saying, yeah, there's always been the struggle,
right,
but now you can look to Christ, the author and finisher of faith, and he'll get you through it.
Right.
Yeah. And don't go back to the old ways, and don't go back to the law,
and
don't look for your best life now. No,
right,
no, it's still coming.
You're just like everybody else, and,
yeah,
and your faith will carry you through to the end, in which,
right,
we all will go together.
Let's apply that for a moment, since you bring it up, Jennifer. Could Abraham possibly have embraced your best life now?
I'm thinking probably not.
No, of course not. He died not having obtained the promise,
right,
and he had God himself promising it to him.
Well, he also had God himself telling. And by the way, it going to be 400 years of...
Oh, right. Oh,
people,
sure.
So it was clear to him that it wasn't going to happen in his life.
No. The biblical hope is always, our hope is in the future. Our hope is not in this lifetime. This lifetime is going to be full of struggle and trial and difficulty, and always has been. So James would write, count it all joy when you suffer these diverse temptations and difficulties, because it's the way it's always been. So I completely reject the whole your best life now thing. Certainly you couldn't have preached that to Abraham, and he's considered the father of faith. He's held up as the example, who against all odds is being promised kids and multitudes and land that belongs to other people. And yet he believes God, and we're still talking about him 4,000 years later. That's the example. That's the book you want to be writing. Trust God even when your circumstances don't look like what you believe God has promised you. Trust him anyway. That's 180 degrees from your best life now. But it's the biblical way to approach it. And so, here we go. I'm back in Genesis 12. Verse 7. The Lord appeared unto Abram and said, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there Abram built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. And he removed from there unto a mountain on the east of Bethel. What does Bethel mean?
House of God.
House of God, exactly. Beth, or house, God, El. And he pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. And there he built an altar unto the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. Okay, now we're just going to finish up this chapter real quick because this story is very interesting. And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land. And it came to pass, when he came near to enter into Egypt, that he said to Sarai, his wife, behold now, I know that you are a fair or a beautiful woman to look at. She's in her 50s here. And 75-year-old Abram is still saying to her, you know, you're a gorgeous babe. And when we go into Egypt, they're going to recognize that you're a gorgeous babe. They're going to get jealous and want to kill me to get you. And so he decides to save his own skin. Now, this is a man who has just had God promise him, through you, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. And those that bless you, I'll bless, and those that curse you, I'll curse. And then he goes into Egypt, and he looks at his wife and goes, you know, you're a hot babe. They're going to kill me to have you. All of the phraseology, gorgeous babe, hot babe, you're not going to find that in the text anywhere. It's not a literal translation. I'm just trying to keep your attention. And he says to his wife, behold, now I know that you are a fair woman to look upon. Therefore, it shall come to pass that when the Egyptians see you, that they will say, this is his wife, and they'll kill me, but they'll save you alive. So he realizes these Egyptian people, these are my enemies. I'm going to go down there with you. They're going to kill me and they're going to keep you. This isn't going to go well for us. Say, I pray thee, or in other words, I'm begging you, do this. Say that you're my sister. Then it may be well with me for your sake, and my soul shall live because of you. How much confidence or faith does he have in God here? None. No demonstration. Okay, so if God made these promises, the six we have so far on the board, if he made those promises conditioned on Abram's continued faith or action or fortitude or stick-to-itiveness, has Abram accomplished any of this then?
No.
Promise is over. Sorry, if there's a single condition here, if the Abrahamic covenant is conditional, Abram just lost the whole thing. All the families of the earth are going to be blessed. You're going to get this land, all that stuff. Never mind. You're not faithful. Forget it, Abram. Never mind. Which is why it is so important that later when God promises him an heir and he believes God, that it says he believed God and God counted it, imputed it to him for righteousness. Abraham gets an imputed foreign righteousness, not his own, which is why I think Moses takes the time to tell us this story. To say, by the way, Abram is not like Mr. Super Faithful Guy. He's like the rest of us. Did he journey into the land of Canaan because God told him to? Yes. Why? By faith. Once he got there, there was a famine. Things went bad in his life. Things went wrong. What did he do? Starts lying and saying, you're my sister and they're going to kill me. And he gets fearful and he loses that great power of faithfulness he seems to have. Does God change the promise or the relationship? No, because it is an unconditional promise, not based on the activities or the faith of the man. That's why I can say to you over and over again, any promise God has made you, he's going to keep. And you'll say to me, yeah, but Jim, you don't know what I'm like. You don't know how often I fail. You don't know how often I can't stand myself anymore. You don't know how frequently my faith just goes right down the tubes and I'm embarrassed to be me. I'm embarrassed in front of God. I want to just crawl under my bed and never come out because I am, in fact, a worm in the truest sense. And I can still look in the eye and say, it's okay. He's loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore, with loving kindness, he's drawing you. It's okay. Your relationship with God is not based on a condition. It's based on everything Christ has already accomplished. It's okay. God didn't choose you because you were really good. He chose you because he's gracious. And it's okay. God's grace shines the brightest against the backdrop of the darkest people. And, you know, if we were just perfect all the time and excellent all the time, what glory is there to God's grace in getting somebody that perfect into heaven? But when he can set us up and call us vessels of mercy and then be able to say, have I told you about this guy? Have I told you about the whole hiding under the bed thing? Have I told you about his faithlessness? Have I told you about the time he went into Egypt and lied about his wife? I had to come and intervene to save his wife because he wouldn't do it, which is the rest of this story we're going to see in a minute. You see, the grace of God that I keep pounding and keep preaching and keep talking about is consistent all the way through the Bible. Whether it's picking Noah, whether it's picking Abram, it's just people like you and I. It's just sinners. It's just broken pottery. It's just people like you and I who left to ourselves simply couldn't do it. And the examples just keep coming and coming through the Bible. And yet the Bible gives us the confidence to stand in front of every broken person and say, faith in Christ is sufficient to guarantee your eternity before God. Because faith is that commodity that God will trade for righteousness. You don't have any righteousness. Quit pretending you do. You have nothing to bring to God, but he will give you righteousness the same way he did Abram, and Abram here is going to be pretty snaky. Snaky was the adjective I went for. And so, verse 15... No, verse 14, and it came to pass that when Abram went into Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. Apparently, the woman's a looker, because he knows it, and the Egyptians know it. The princes, also of Pharaoh, saw her. She was so good-looking that there were princes under Pharaoh, who saw her on the streets and went, we got to tell Pharaoh about her. She's exceptional. And the princes also of Pharaoh saw her and commended her before Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Now, the good likelihood is that she was taken into Pharaoh's house to be cleaned up and go through a series of purifications and everything else to eventually be taken to Pharaoh for the possibility of being a wife or at very least concubine. He would have had a good number of women at that point. And so she's being prepared to be intimate with Pharaoh. Verse 16. And Pharaoh entreated Abram well for her sake. Oh, this is your brother? Oh, well, that's great, because I'm liking her, so I'll treat you well. And he gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and manservants and maidservants and camels and made him rich. In an agricultural society like that, he made Abram rich. Now think about it for a moment, because there's this wonderful compatibilism I keep talking about. God is taking Abram into Canaan. Once he gets him there, he brings a famine. The famine drives him into Egypt. When he gets there, Abram lies about his wife. Because of the lie, Pharaoh makes Abram rich. I mean, like rich, rich. You're going to see later that when he and Lot start contending with each other, it's because they both have such huge herds, they can no longer stay in the same area of Canaan together because their herdsmen are fighting over, you know, the best land for their fields to graze and everything else. I mean, these guys are phenomenally rich. When Lot is overtaken by the five kings and captured, Abram goes after him with his own standing army. This is a rich guy. You getting a feel for this? This is a phenomenally wealthy, powerful guy. Where does he get all that money and power and wealth? Down in Egypt as a result of his lie. God uses his lie to set him up with all the power and money and everything God intends for him to have when he goes back to Canaan. And so, verse 17, this is again fascinating. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with a great plague because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Now, there had to have been a conversation somewhere in the middle here because Pharaoh calls Abram and says, what is this you have done unto me? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister so that I might have taken her to me to wife? Now, therefore, behold your wife. Take her and go your way. And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away and his wife and all that he had. Now, think about this. Pharaoh wanted to take Sarah to wife and could have potentially produced offspring, except that God's promise is that through Abram and his wife Sarah, they're going to produce the seed, the promised seed, through which all the families of the earth are going to be blessed, which is going to be completely messed up if Pharaoh sleeps with Sarah, especially if Sarah gets pregnant. So God brings a plague on the house of Pharaoh to protect her, and in so doing, God kept Pharaoh from sinning against himself. Isn't that remarkable? We're talking about a really sovereign God here. I keep saying we're talking about this really, really sovereign God. God knew that if Pharaoh did what Pharaoh wanted to do, Pharaoh was not only going to mess up God's plan, but sin against God, and God kept everything bad from happening by doing what? Bringing something worse, bringing a plague onto his house. He brought a plague onto the house of Pharaoh until Pharaoh figured out that something was wrong, that he realized he was being plagued by God. And then there had to have been a conversation somewhere in the middle where either Sarah or Abram or somebody said, hey, I know what's going on here. Sorry, we lied. And he had to have been amazed that whatever God this was would do all this to protect these two. So it's no wonder he gave him all the stuff. You don't try to take stuff back from somebody who has a God like that protecting him. And he sends him out of Egypt with his wife and all this wealth, which he then uses once he gets into the land of Canaan. So God used Abram's lie to make Abram really rich, which is what God intended to do in the first place when he sent him to Egypt. Isn't that fascinating? Do you think that God can help you pay your electric bill? You think that God can get you through these problems in life? Look at the way he works. Look at the way he takes care of his people. Look at the way he protects his own. And once he makes a promise, he cannot go back on that promise. And so however badly you mess up your life, he's still going to work it out anyway to fulfill his promises to you, because they're unconditional promises. He's going to do whatever it takes to fulfill every promise he's ever made to you. That's the God you're dealing with. Yes, ma'am.
Is there any way for us to know how long they were there? Because Pharaoh had to have, when all this stuff started happening, I mean, to me, it seems like it would have had to have happened pretty quickly in order for him to realize that, hey, maybe
yeah,
maybe
something's gone terribly awry here.
Yeah. I mean, and I just wondered, how
It doesn't say, and I don't have any idea how long. We don't really know. Yes, certain things had to have happened. Mm-hmm. She had to have enough time to be brought into Pharaoh's house and, kind of into that cleansing process that they would have gone through. And Abram has to have time to have gained favor with Pharaoh and, got all his wealth and stuff. There's a period of time there that had to have passed, and enough time for the plagues to happen and for Pharaoh to make the connection. So, I wish Moses had given us a lot more info, but I think that a lot when I read the Bible. But no, all we get to work with is this story. And if that's all Moses gave us, that's because that's all he figured was important. And what he really gave us was the theological stuff. He gave us the stuff that would help us identify that God was faithful even when Abram wasn't. We'll pick up right there next week, and the promises are going to grow. God is not done yet. The Abrahamic covenant is going to continue to be expanded, and God is going to state it and restate it and then hand it down generation to generation, and it's going to continue to have this very identifiable, geographic, physical tone to it. And then we're going to look at some of the later prophetic writings and writing in the Psalms where later generations say, and God fulfilled these physical promises to physical people, so we know that they identified the promises as being very literal and physical to their people. And we'll use that as our basis for understanding the new covenant.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.